This week we're off to the Liverpool Plains in New South Wales, where a weekly cricket comp helps take farmers' minds off the drought. A 100-year-old traction engine fires into life in Victoria, and we join a choir crawl in Wentworth. We also learn about making non-alcoholic grape juices, and Barossa blokes get into the spirit of things, baking for the Tanunda Show.
Firstly, I want to thank you all for entering and going out of your way to enter into this chocolate cake. I think you've done a mighty job, you've done a super job, and you've to be congratulated.
We'll check out their culinary skills a little bit later. But first up, let's meet some blokes in New South Wales who are probably a bit more comfortable putting their sporting prowess to the test.
You better go back to the left.
Yes, Johnny.
This is going to be the most dangerous interview I've ever done. It's late on a Wednesday afternoon, and there's something a little bit different about the cricket match that I'm at. Hello, I'm Lisa Herbert, and I'm walking out to the pitch at the Spring Ridge Sports Ground on the Liverpool Plains near Tamworth in northwest New South Wales. Over there, I can see a couple of beers sitting behind the stumps, and most of the players remain in their work gear, straight from the farm, boots and all. Seven teams play in this annual midweek summer comp that's been going for around 25 years. The guys make their living off the land, and a few hours of bush cricket takes them away from some of those tough, long days on the farm as the drought continues to take its toll. G'day, Nick.
Hey, Lisa. How you going?
Not too bad. Can I stand with you at the crease?
Yeah, you're right. Just watch the balls coming back.
What's the score so far? What are you on?
I think we're 4 for probably 50-odd. Which is not the best situation to be in, but...
How often do you do this?
Every Wednesday, in January through to March. Good running, boys, good running. We usually play seven aside, so there's usually 14 people here. Not many supporters. Oh, it depends, sometimes you get a few people. Oh, it was brought in probably 20 years ago, just an excuse for the farmers to get together and relax and have a few beers. And daylight saving. Plenty of time to play till 7:30.
Not everyone playing is in runners or cricket shoes. There's a few boots around.
Yeah, well, some people have come straight off the tractor and straight off the spray rig. So, yeah, it's just whatever you come in, you come in.
How serious does it get?
This is local derby, so it's friendly banter. But, yeah, some teams take it pretty seriously. But between us two, it's pretty good fun.
That was bold. Out.
Put your bat in front of the stump!
Hi, I'm Dave. I don't know how many runs around, Lisa. They tell you you have to retire at 30. I think I've run 45.
What role does this game play every Wednesday afternoon?
It gets us off the farm. Have a bloody good time. We otherwise were there on our own, really.
All right, who's this bowler?
Ben Clift. He's old like me.
So where should I stand? Are you going to hit this one or not?
I'd stand at first slip. I'll hit your catch. That's over there next to this bloke with the gloves. Okay?
All right. I'm going to duck.
She's not taking my advice.
Okay, I've left the wicket. Moving to, I don't know, is this third man? Where are you?
One of my cow corner.
Why do you play this game?
Oh, I'm on a family farm here, so Dave's my uncle, actually. Mm-hmm. So I've just come in and help out, and whenever they need someone, I just come and play. So it's been pretty good.
David Brownhill just got a six over my head. It's been played over the years in all sorts of seasons. This might be one of the worst.
It is. I've got some photos of Mullally a couple of weeks ago. It's on the actual field's on the stock route, and it was just bare dirt, completely bare dirt, and all there is a cement green strip in the middle.
We hear a lot of mental health and maintaining it as best you can in all sorts of seasons, and the experts say exercise and also social interaction is great for that. So you're hitting, I hate to use a cliche, but you're scoring two runs with that.
Yeah, exactly, and it is good, and we're lucky here. Like, it was dry, it didn't rain for a couple of months, well, nearly 3 months. But, you know, clearly there's obviously people elsewhere that are still dry and a lot drier. And we didn't get a lot of rain to really make a big difference yet, but it's better than nothing. And there's a guy diving for the first time ever. New dad, Nick Beer, he's clearly got some issues with his brain cells. This is also known as Spiny Bird Park, so the idea is to stay on your feet. Have a look around you. Yeah, so it's a sports like community, but it just really gets everyone together midweek. And, you know, they still might probably talk about farming, or they might talk about something else, but it just gets everyone together. And it's competitive, it's good fun. And, like, these two teams are both from Spring Ridge, Actually, we might lose this game, Lucian. This will be the first game we've lost all year, of the proper competition, that is. So I don't know if you're helping us or not right now.
Well, I seem to be a ball magnet.
Should I make a comment on that?
Ben Hubbard, square leg from Spring Ridge. We're up by a few. Looks like we're going to beat them here. So tough day, though. A lot of competition.
What have you done today?
Been swathing some stubble for straw for feed.
And you've come from the farm in your work boots still, and now you're taken to the cricket pitch.
Yep, straight from the farm, straight to the pub for a couple, and then down to the cricket pitch for the game.
What role does a bit of fun on a Wednesday night play?
Look, I think it's all about having a few beers and being social and a bit of competition, the boys getting together. I think it's very important. Well, it's good to be social, and you don't get to see a lot of people here all the time, so anytime you get a group of people together to play a bit of sport and have a few beers, it's always fun.
Do you talk about farming or issues or drought or anything like that?
Oh, I think when you put a bunch of farmers together, they're all going to talk about farming, but yeah, everyone talks about farming for sure, yeah.
What do you think the topic will be tonight?
Oh, I'd say it'll be our win.
Oh, nice! Oh!
My name's John Brown, and I'm from Warrnambool. Yeah, what we're looking at here is it's a 1909 steam traction engine built in England by a company called Foden's. It's the forerunner, really, to modern tractors. It's steam-driven. It's a little bit like a railway locomotive, but it's something that goes on the road.
And he forgot to mention it's big, really big, and loud. G'day, Brett Worthington with you at the Alansford Field Day in southwest Victoria, where this grand old steam-powered beauty is attracting a lot of admiring glances. I'm standing right next to the back wheel here, which must be at least 2 metres high.
You're right, it's a little over 2 metres. It's 7 feet in the old money, which is 2.1 metres, and it's a little bit more than that because we've got the rubber tyres on it. So what we're looking at is a thing that weighs about 15 tonnes. In its heyday, this one was bought by the Barrabool Shire, which is down near Geelong, and was used for driving a stone crusher to crush stone in their quarries for road building. After that, it was sold on to private ownership and contractors, and they used it for other jobs such as driving chaff cutters and threshing machines and general agricultural kind of work.
And how did it come into your hands?
Yes, well, we bought it from the previous owner. He lived at Bright, way up in the northeast of Victoria, and him and his father throughout the 1960s used to travel on the roads all through northern Victoria towing a chaff cutter and turning up at farms and turning their oat and hay into chaff. And they're ideal for that because you often need steam to in the chaff cutting process, and so you've got a ready supply of steam there to steam the chaff as you're cutting it.
And what do you use it for today?
Oh, these days, really, it's just something that we just like to display and we take to... There's quite a strong steam engine fraternity, quite a movement, and there's a rally at twice a year at a place called Lake Goldsmith near Beaufort and Ballarat, and we keep a couple of traction engines there and we display them regularly.
What's involved in keeping it maintained and keeping it going?
There's quite a bit involved, actually. The boiler is the main thing that requires a lot of maintenance, and it needs regular inspections, usually biannual, depending on how often it's being used. So you need a qualified boiler inspector to come and inspect the boiler and issue a certificate so that it's safe to use.
And how important is it that this kind of machinery is maintained and does have a future?
Well, look, I think it's important to... It's preserving our heritage, really, and people tend to forget. We're in the modern days now, we all think that the modern type of motor car and motor vehicle has been in existence sort of forever, until you look at these things and realise that there was a forerunner to the modern motive power, and this is it, and it's good to keep it alive.
And so if we came back in another 100 years, you'd like to think that it might still be on show somewhere?
There's absolutely no reason why it couldn't be. It's just a matter of keeping that boiler in well maintained and in good condition. Generally speaking, if any parts wear out, we just have to go and make them. So we might have to go and make a wooden pattern, get a part cast at a foundry, and then machine it up and just fit it to the machine again, and it's ready to go.
And is it an expensive thing to maintain? Like, is it a thing of love that you do it for?
It is. It requires a lot of commitment, and you do need to be really keen because it's heavy work working on them, and driving them. It's dirty, so you've really got to love it. But I guess once you get the smell of hot oil and steam in your veins, there's no going back.
Steam enthusiast John Brown keeping his 100-year-old traction engine in tip-top condition. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, an enterprising young winemaker experiments with non-alcoholic sparkling grape juices. Kimushi choirs perform at Wentworth, and it's crunch time at the Tanunda Show for some nervous bakers.
Firstly, I want to thank you all for entering and going out of your way to enter into this chocolate cake. I think you've done a mighty job, you've done a super job, and you've to be congratulated.
There are a lot of nervous blokes standing in the hall at the moment. 10 chocolate cakes sit proudly on the table. Some are iced elaborately, maybe to hide what's underneath. Hello, I'm Lauren Waldhuter at Tanunda in South Australia's Barossa Valley, where the special men's chocolate cake section is about to be judged at the local agricultural show. One of the cooks trying to take out today's top honour is Peter Liebelt. He's standing at the side with a small band of supporters.
I'm sweating. Because it's quite embarrassing, really. I don't know, it just doesn't look that good.
I think it looks good, and I think the group of people you got here are pretty proud. Are you guys all proud?
Oh, yeah. We're proud.
Heaps proud.
So how would you describe your cooking skills?
Ordinary, at best.
Tell me about the process. When did you make the cake? What did you have to do?
The first one was a flop. The second one I cooked about 11 o'clock last night. Probably and finished it this morning, so that's about it.
Today, Margaret Hurst has been given the tough job of choosing the winner. She's been a cake judge for more than 3 decades, and not much gets past her.
I've been a judge at the Royal for 23 years and out in the country probably for 30 years, so I've been, you know, doing it for a long time.
Now, somebody's tested that with a skewer. Can you see?
She moves slowly up and down the table, inspecting, cutting, and of course, tasting.
Something went wrong there, didn't it? It's not cooked there, can you see? That's quite nice. The icing's probably a little bit thick, but I suppose you like icing, do you?
Dan Eggleton, like a few others in the room, goes a little white every time Margaret Hurst gets close to his culinary masterpiece.
Well, there's a range of rules that weren't explained in the book, like namely she's got to be able to pick it up, but I'm incredibly deflated. First ever chocolate cake, I was high on hopes, but I've run out of distant last, I think. I'm going to be still running.
What has she said about your cake?
Bugger all, just shook her head and said, nah, that was it.
What was that like, that moment when you realised you're probably not going to take out the ribbon?
Well, it's probably satisfying because then I won't be expected to do it at home.
So you're not going to enter next year?
Oh, we're thinking about moving under the German cake section. It looks a bit flatter, a bit more bread-like and everything, so yes.
Not so many competitors.
No, there's only one competitor in the novice, so we're set.
So what have you learnt, if you could sum it up for maybe some other guys that are listening and thinking about entering next year, what have you learnt about making a cake?
Well, two things. Mm-hmm. One of them, keep it really super simple. And secondly, don't listen to your wife and her suggestion of what to make.
Why not?
Well, obviously it didn't work.
As the final decision looms, the crowd gets louder.
It looked pretty, but it's not cooked there, can you see? See, that's got cake rack marks on the bottom.
But then, the moment they've all been waiting for.
Okay, the first prize winner was to Daryl Greer. Where's Rex Liebelt? Congratulations, Mr. Second Prize Winner.
Unfortunately, Daryl Greer wasn't around to accept his ribbon, but nobody looks too upset with the result. I asked Margaret Hurst if she has any tips for next year.
Well, not to put it on our floor. Not to use a skewer to put it because it shows through the cake, and not to put it on a cake rack, but just put it on a cake rack with a towel underneath it, because if you're looking for something, sometimes a cake might be very close, and you've got to split the winners and you look for these little defects. So they're the main three things that I've pointed out today.
The crowd starts to disappear, but not before one final message.
So you've done a super job. But next year I expect some of you guys to come into some of the other competition, the open comp, and give these girls a run for their money. Because I think you've got it in you.
I'd like to get the next one, Matt.
Yeah, well, I reckon it's only not far away.
Nice big berries this year.
I do like to kick back at the end of the day with a nice glass of wine, but would I like it as much if it was non-alcoholic? Hello, Olivia Garnett with you, and I'm between Bridgetown and Boyup Brook in the southwest corner of Western Australia. Using skills she's developed in the family vineyard, it's here that Alana Starkey is experimenting with five different grape varieties to create a range of non-alcoholic sparkling grape juices.
Try these.
It's basically a spin-off from my father's winery. I grew up on a winery and learned a lot about the winemaking process as we were growing up and looking after grapes. And basically we wanted to try and do something that was a bit different. And once I finished uni and came back down here to live, we thought there was a bit of an opportunity to try and make a different product and something that was non-alcoholic. And that's where the idea came from.
I would say the best part about wine is the alcohol content myself. So how much of a demand is there for non-alcoholic beverages?
We're actually finding that there's a big demand for it. I mean, obviously there are people who sort of come up and try it and say, oh, what's the point if it doesn't have alcohol in it? But there is actually quite a reasonable population in Australia of people who don't want to drink, either for religious reasons, young women who might be pregnant or breastfeeding, people who just don't want to drink full stop. And there's also the people who might not want to drink on occasion. So if they're the designated skipper, if they're the designated driver, if they're out and about, and also young teenagers who want to fit in with the crowd but don't necessarily want to drink.
How do you then maintain the grape characteristics while then stopping it from being alcoholic or fermenting?
So basically, we handpick everything. We try and get really good quality grapes wherever we get them from. So we buy them from several different suppliers. The red grapes you buy off my father, because obviously that's a more red grape growing region. And we get our white grapes from further down south. So we try and pick the region. We try and pick really good quality grapes. And then we manage them carefully. But basically, they've still got a lot of character as they come straight out of the press. So that's what we're trying to capitalise on.
Now, in front of us, we've got a couple of bottles of the sparkling grape juice. I notice you've chosen to name them the names of the grape varieties, so Shiraz, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc. Yep. Does that confuse people, seeing as it's a non-alcoholic drink?
Initially, it might confuse people, but once people have gotten used to the idea, they actually really like the idea that it's that the varietals are named, because then they can start to taste the characters of the different grapes. So there's that grassy, acidic flavours of the Sauvignon Blanc. There's the sort of sweet, nutty characters of the Chardonnay, and the Shiraz has got that real raspberry berry taste to it. So it's once they've understood what the idea is behind the drink, yeah, they like looking for those different flavours that they can recognise in a wine.
So going back to the processing, how do you actually stop it from fermenting? Or is this a secret?
No, it's not a secret. It's basically straight out of the press and into a cold stainless steel tank. So the main thing is keeping it cold and also stopping any fermentation before it starts. Once it started fermenting, it's almost impossible to stop. You don't want to get it that far. Basically, the whole process is done really, really fast and really cold. In the absence of oxygen, if you can.
You really only have one shot a year to get it absolutely right.
One shot, but that's another reason why we've done a couple of different varieties, so that we've got a couple of batches of the different varieties, so that if one happens to start fermenting, then not all is lost. We've got a few different varieties to back us up.
It's a fine art, Alana. Where did you learn these winemaking skills?
Well, there's been a lot of learning and trial and error along the way as well for the last couple of years, so it's all been a matter of learning and asking different people. Like we've talked to beer makers as well to get ideas from their process, and just sort of brought it all in together to try and refine our process.
Have you had any interest from overseas yet?
Surprisingly, we actually have. We've had several inquiries as to, export for our juice, mostly from countries that either for religious reasons don't want to drink, so Dubai, but also China, where they've just brought in a zero alcohol driving policy. So, yeah, we're not quite at the production levels yet where we can support export, but that's definitely something we'll look to in the future.
I wanted to do an event for the Mildura Wentworth Arts Festival that would bring people of interest the same interest to Wentworth, so that we had almost a rent-a-crowd situation, so we'll all go and listen to each other. Where shall I be
when it sounds so loud? You could say it's a bit like a sanctimonious pub crawl, except the pubs have been replaced with churches and community halls, and the draw card is music, not beer. Hello, I'm Charlotte King in the small town of Wentworth, in the far southwest corner of New South Wales, just across the border from Mildura. The region's been celebrating its annual arts festival, and this choir crawl is the final event in the calendar. In all, 10 different community choirs have joined forces to fill various venues throughout the afternoon. One of the organisers is Wentworth's Artback Cafe owner, Anne Hendricks.
I'd always been in choirs right from when I was a little girl, and it seemed that community choirs and singing were the best way to go to bring a lovely community element into Wentworth and something quite different. So Walk Wentworth Sing was born in discussion with Paul Lambeth from Arts Mildura, and so we're all it's happening.
Were you aware of how many different choirs there were in the region before, when you came up with the idea, or did that come afterwards?
I was aware that there were a lot of choirs. I'd made a list anyway, but some other choirs came out of, you know, from other people's knowledge, including the Tongan Youth Choir. I didn't know they were practicing regularly, so that was a really nice element to have involved as well. And involving the ukulele groups was a really nice thing to do. So I knew about the major choirs, of course, but reforming out what was Silverwater into Women in Harmony, just a small group, was just an absolute joy.
Over at the town hall next, there is the Sunraysia Ukulele Network singing with their ukes. The program's there to keep singing. Each concert's about 40 minutes.
Yeah, hi, I'm Faye White, and I'm a singer-songwriter. I work as a freelance community music person, I guess. I work with choirs and community groups, community music making.
And so what's the point, I suppose, of bringing multiple choirs together in an event like this? What can come out of it?
Joie de vie. Actually, you know, it's a lot of joy and a lift for everybody. And there's something about singing together. We do know there's heaps of research about the positive effects of singing together, which is different from singing by yourself. Singing with rather than singing to. When you sing with other people, there's a connection that's quite different from anything else. It also increases your endorphin levels and your immunoglobulin A levels. It actually increases your immunity to sing together. So there's, you know, this has been tested and tried and researched. So there's more than the sum of the parts when people get together to sing. It's a great leveller as well, which is goes beyond all the boundaries that we put up between our different groups. And it's all good, I reckon.
The ukulele singers, ending that story from Charlotte King on the choir crawl at this year's Mildura Wentworth Arts Festival.